beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matters such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
Today on Rainbow Country, coverage of the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. That next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello and welcome to a brand new journey through Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. And as always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. By the way, Rainbow Country originates from CIUT-FM in Toronto and now proudly in syndication across Canada. Thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Rainbow Country is also a number one Canadian LGBT podcast. So today, a spotlight on two Canadian films that are part of the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. Modern Whore, a documentary that explores the experiences of Toronto sex worker Andrea Werhahn, who, by the way, was a consultant on the Oscar-winning film Anora. Bloodlines, a Canadian Indigenous lesbian romance that celebrates Métis culture, all wrapped up with a plot twist that will leave audiences talking. And in hour two, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, and classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. First up, activist and author Tim McCaskill talks about the early days of Canada's gay and lesbian community.
When we talk about the LGBTQ community as if it is something that just exists, I think we're indulging in wishful thinking. Communities aren't something that spring fully formed from the ether. They require some assembly. They need to be constructed. Still thinking about the 70s here, when I came out in Toronto, there were lots of different parts that didn't quite fit together. First, there were gay men who went to bars and baths. Most were pretty deeply in the closet. They shared a dirty secret and some overlapping friendship networks, but not much else. Then there were a self-proclaimed clutch of young activists around the body politic and the Gay Alliance Towards Equality, myself included, who tended to be a bit judgmental about anyone not properly out and willing to throat ram. In fact, one writer to the body politic called us the high principle Jesus Christ farts of the movement. Then there were the new class of gay entrepreneurs who were establishing the first gay businesses along Church Street. The Community Homophile Association was perhaps the largest organization in town, and it was run by George Hislop, a part owner of several of these businesses. The entrepreneurs saw the activists as troublemakers rocking a precarious boat, and we saw them as conservatives unable to embrace gay liberation. We felt much the same about MCC, the major gay-focused Christian organization at the time. When women from chat calling themselves the cunts broke off and denounced Hislop as a sexist in 1971, it made clear that a lot of women were also on a pretty different wavelength. Most lesbians were much more comfortable in feminist circles than hanging around with gay men. Not that they all agreed either. There were always the lesbian socialist feminists versus the radical feminist lesbians, and so on. Trans organizing was small and generally had little to do with any of us. Trans men were often concerned with distinguishing themselves from lesbians, and trans women were unwelcome in most lesbian spaces. Gay men were generally suspicious, unclear on the differences between sexual orientation and sexual identity. So it was all a bit of a hot mess. I suppose if you see community like a dysfunctional family where everybody fights all the time, you could call it a community. But if by community you mean people who are cooperating and fighting for a common goal, that probably didn't really happen until the 1980s, when we were all faced with challenges that we couldn't overcome alone. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
When I return, Bloodlines.
Hi, everybody. This is Gino Vannelli. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Toronto is f***ing fantastic.
Gail Maurice. Hello. Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. And yourself?
I am good. I am good. I have to say thank you for returning to Rainbow Country, because you and I met in person during TIFF in 2022 to talk about your then film, a great film, Rosie.
Okay. Yeah.
So we talked about that. That's when you and I first met, and we're here again today to talk about your current film, Bloodlines. Thank you for being here and to talk to me about this. Mm-hmm. This film, Bloodlines, mm-hmm. Talk to me essentially about the story that you're telling in Bloodlines.
So Bloodlines has been with me for a long time. I started it 20 years ago, and the seed of it began in Regina in a lesbian bar. And I was shooting a film. I can't remember which one it was. And I had a night off, so I went to this bar. And then later on that night, I was lying in bed, and I thought, what if I brought one of those beautiful indigenous woman home, and what if I fell in love? And so that's where the kernel of the initial story began. And 20 years later, this version of Bloodlines is about two women who fall in love. And it's one of the main characters, Beatrice, has an antagonistic relationship with her mother, who abandoned her as a child, and she is dealing
with... And you play the mother?
I play the mother, only because our casting director, Melanie Braid, did an amazing job casting authentically queer leads. And also we wanted Northern Mitchiff speaking actors, and we couldn't find any to play my character who could ad lib with the main, the three, we call them lovingly the granny gang, because my character has to ad lib with them. And so they have to understand each other. So I brought three of these actors from my village, because there's only five villages in the world that speak my dialect of Michif, which is the Métis language. It's a mixture of Cree and French. And so the story is about two women who fall in love, and also about family, family bonds, and what makes us who we are. Is it the blood that flows through our veins, or is it the culture we were raised in? Mm.
They often say, write what you know, write mm-hmm. what you know. So is this story that you're telling, is this a personal story that maybe you've lived or you've heard from friends, or is this something that is just fiction?
I think the way I write is I write from personal experience. I think that's the most powerful way for the way I write, because there's a lot of truth in my stories. So yes, there's some moments in my story that are part of my life. Yes, I wish I could tell you more. But if I do, it's going to give away.
Exactly. And yeah. We don't want that.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you just mentioned this. You just mentioned the name, the Granny Gang. Mm-hmm. I loved these three characters. So much fun. What's the origin story of having these three characters in this film? Was this always the plan to have them be part of the film, or did this evolve over time?
It evolved in this iteration of the story. Initially, when the story began, it was just focusing on, it was set in the city. It was very, very dark. There was there's no aspect of Beatrice, the main character, that you're left liking. So in this story, the Granny Gang is basically like aunties. You know the auntie movement? So they're like aunties, and aunties can tell you anything. They can say, hey, stop that, smarten up. You know, they can slap you around, not physically, but with their words to get you to, think straight or not straight. I always say there's no straight, it's always a little windy, but just to make you think before you, I guess, make mistakes. So to me, the Granny Gang, they have words of wisdom. They tell you like it is, but also they're funny, you know? Yeah.
They are. They're great. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this movie, Bloodlines, there's a major plot twist mm-hmm. in this film. And the audience has to see this film to appreciate this plot twist. But because of this twist, when you were originally making this film and you know, seeking funding or backers or what have you, mm-hmm. did you get any pushback because of the plot twist?
I didn't. I got pushback at one point because it was a lesbian love story. And when I got that pushback, I don't want to say which funding body gave me the feedback, but I didn't get funding that year. And I called them and they said, why does it have to be a story about two lesbians? Why can't it be just the story about the mother and daughter? And they said, nobody's read the script. For all we know, it could be the most beautiful script ever. So they read the synopsis and, the budget, and that was what the decision was based on. And when I was told, why does it have to be a lesbian love story? I was so disillusioned, so crushed, so in disbelief, so fucking angry that a gatekeeper was doing that. Like, I at that point I didn't see how I could make a film in this country if there were gatekeepers like that. So I almost quit the industry because I was so, I was just disillusioned. I didn't know how I could ever make a film if that was the type of person that was going to be, you know, allowing me to make a film or not. So I quit film. I didn't do anything, I think, for about 2-3 years. And then one day, or maybe 2 years, and then one day I said, fuck it, I'm not going to let them, sorry if I'm swearing, I said, fuck it, I'm not going to let, you know, them control me or stop me from telling my story. So I locked myself in the closet, literally, at my partner Melanie Bray's mom's house. Her dad had a closet that he made into a little office. So I locked myself up there for 3 days, and I wrote Rosie the Short, that became Rosie the Feature, that became a TIFF Top 10 in 2022. And from there, I went back to Bloodlines and I said, damn it, I'm going to do this again. And the story's not going to leave my body. And I went back for funding. And because Rosie was a hit, they funded it.
Wow. That's quite the story. That's quite the journey.
Yeah.
So when you look back on that journey, what do you take away from that?
That person had since been fired, had gatekeeper. But my takeaway from that is never to give up and never to allow anybody to stomp on who you are, who your spirit is. And never allow anybody to deny your story, you know, and deny your truth, and to make you feel as if being queer should not be spoken about or filmed or shown to the world, you know, like that's my takeaway. It's, I think, that we're beautiful. I'm beautiful. Our stories are beautiful. Our stories are unique, and every one of us should be celebrated.
Well said. Well said. So, a lesbian romance wrapped up in a celebration of Métis culture. You are one of, I believe, 1,130 people in the world that speak the Michif language. Mm-hmm. For you, using your talents, your platform, your filmmaking skills to bring this language to an audience, what does that mean for you personally to be able to do that on such a big, in such a big way, to keep this language going?
When I found out there was only that many speakers in the world, and I found out through the National Film Board, they're the ones that says there's only 1,130 Michif speakers, and that's Michif speakers. The dialect that I speak, Northern Michif, is far fewer. Like I said, there's only 5 villages in Canada, in the world, that actually speak my dialect of Michif. And for me, having my language in my films is just a way to honor my ancestors, honor my grandmother, honor, you know, the people I come from. It's my language is my culture. My language is my life. In when I speak Michif, if I talk like that, you know, there's 99.9% of the world would never understand me. So I have to put my language in my films so that people can hear it and hear the sound and hear the beauty. When we say tree, mitus, it's not just a tree. It's like, it's a living thing. Everything is living, and my ancestors touched that tree, and it has a story. So my language creates a beauty in the world through the spoken word. It evokes like history, you know. So when I speak my language, my ancestors are talking through me.
Mm. So this movie features a lot of music,
mm-hmm.
including a one Dolly Parton. And I think like her song is played, especially when the granny gang is around,
mm-hmm.
in their car.
Well, the cassette player is stuck because it's so old. So it always comes on. At one point, I wanted one of the characters, I wanted Beatrice to say, you better get that cassette player fixed. But then I thought, nah, I just let it be.
So why Dolly Parton then?
Oh my gosh, she's so iconic, and it just, her voice, and we all love Dolly Parton, and the granny gang loves Dolly Parton. And she's just like, she symbolizes a lot, you know? When I grew up, I grew up without television. Not that I'm ancient, but it's just the way it is in Northern Saskatchewan. We had one radio station, and we would hear Dolly Parton on the radio, you know? So she's a cultural icon.
So here is my second to last question for you, and it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen Bloodlines?
I hope that they come away with, I guess, wanting to know more about Métis culture, wanting to know more, or I guess I would love them to walk away going, wow, because there's so many Canadians that I've met on my time here on Earth that don't even know what being Métis is, or don't even know what Métis is, and they're Canadians. So I hope they walk away with an understanding. But not only that, people were asking about, you know, about the queer representation in the story, but when I came out, my grandma accepted me. Nothing. It wasn't even a thing for anybody. So that's, it's not even a thing in Bloodlines. It simply is, you know? Being queer for these two women is simply who they are. And there's, I wanted to show, that it's not a thing, you know, it just is. They're beautiful and accepted.
So here's my last question, and it's essentially three really quick questions.
Okay.
One word answers, essentially.
Okay.
So are you ready for these three quick questions? Okay, first one, red or white?
Red.
Day or night?
Ooh, that's a tough one because I love the moon, but I also love the sun. Day.
So this next one, I ask with all due respect. So please take it in that vein.
Oh God, what the hell is it? Oh my God.
Masturbator or not?
Masturbator. Big time.
And that is from your film.
It is.
I laughed so hard when that was said. In your film.
Yes.
By the granny gang.
Yeah.
Well done to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Gail Maurice, thank you for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. And see you at TIFF.
realise what TIFF actually stands for. Toronto is f***ing fantastic.
Bloodlines is currently screening at the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. For more information, simply visit tiff.net. When I return, Modern Horror.
Hi, I'm Agnes. My new record, Magic Still Exists, is out now. You are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is gay hip-hop artist, the Mangfather Bob Katz. An artist friend of mine recommended that I check out Mark Tara's Rainbow Country years ago, and I've been enjoying it ever since. Mark's excellent interviews highlight all aspects of the LGBTQ community, and he's not afraid to ask the difficult questions that other hosts avoid. And I love, love, love the music that Mark plays on Rainbow Country each week, especially when he plays my music. But seriously, Mark Tara has been such a supporter of my music and has turned me on to so many great LGBTQ artists that I'd never heard of before. I'm so grateful to Mark Tara's Rainbow Country.
So I wanted to take this time to let you know about the next evolution of Rainbow Country, simply called Rainbow Country Plus, streaming 24/7 on YouTube. It's currently live, and to check it out, simply head over to marktara.ca, where, of course, everything is connected, and hit the poster. It's right there, it's simple, and of course, it's free. And currently features interviews from filmmakers that have been part of the Toronto International Film Festival that I've had the honor of interviewing. So I hope you'll take a little time and check it out. Rainbow Country Plus, the next evolution of this little gay radio show.
My name is Joanne Vanicola, and I'm an actor and a writer, and I was first on Rainbow Country with Mark Tara on discussing the massacre at Pulse Club in Orlando. I realized how important it was for our community to have a radio station specifically for our issues to talk about people in the LGBTQ community and to provide an outlet for our stories, to discuss our politics, culture, and give voice to the issues that matter to us. And, of course, our artists and the things that we do globally and talk about culture. And without people like Mark Tara providing a space for this with a radio show like this, then we wouldn't have that voice. So, support. Tune in. Thank you.
I'm Billy Newton Davis, and we're sitting here on Rainbow Country with the fabulous Mark Tara.
Good evening, everyone. How are you? Whoa! You guys are excited, aren't you?
Toronto!
This is a very exciting night for us.
I'm really freaking excited to be here tonight.
What a great audience.
I'm so excited to be here. It's such a great honor.
And I'm so honored to be able to show my film to this august crowd.
What's really fun is people who love film, and you are all that. And we're very proud and happy to be here with all of you.
We should not be afraid to tell stories because we are afraid that people will judge.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity and a platform to be able to showcase our work as female filmmakers.
This is for my parents who couldn't come, so thank you. I'm going to prove it to them. I did it!
I've just realized what TIFF actually stands for. Toronto is fucking fantastic.
This is the story of our city, and we're a very proud city.
and I want the world to see it.
My name is Andrea Warehun. I'm a writer and performer, and I'm also a sex worker.
In books, movies, and every syndicated crime drama imaginable, sex workers are typically portrayed as victims or villains. Shame and stigma can silence us. It's high time we told our own damn stories. Here's mine.
Nicole Bazine, hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, Mark. Thank you so much for having us.
Andrea Warehun, hello. How are you?
Hello, I'm great. How are you?
I am well. I am better now that I'm speaking to the two of you, especially about your new Canadian feature film, a documentary called Modern Whore. Modern Whore. That is the title. Andrea, let's start with yourself. You are a producer. You co-wrote the screenplay. You star in this documentary, in this film. It is based on your memoir, I believe your 2017 memoir. Talk to me essentially about the story that you're telling in this documentary, Modern Whore.
Well, the Modern Whore documentary spans a sex work career that's now like basically 15 years long. I started escorting in my early 20s and quit and then got another job. I got lots of other jobs in the interim, then went into stripping, where I am still currently employed as an artist who is trying to make a living as an artist. I am also a stripper. The documentary is based on the book Modern Whore that I co-created with Nicole that looks at the sort of wide breadth of those experiences. And what we're able to do with the documentary is bring it to life in a way that goes beyond my personal experience in the industry and incorporates the perspectives of other sex workers and also the people in my life who know about my sex work and love me, like my mom and my partner, and I also interview one of my customers.
Mm. Nicole, you are a producer. You co-wrote the screenplay. Talk to me essentially about the evolution of Modern Whore, going from a memoir to a short film, now a feature-length documentary. Talk to me about this evolution and how this all came about, because the two of you have been like a dynamic duo for a while now.
Thank you for calling us a dynamic duo. I think that's definitely how we liked to see ourselves.
Or some modern whores, one or the other.
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah, we met actually in 2011, Andrea and I. So we've been longtime friends, longtime like creative co-conspirators with everything we wanted to achieve together. And, you know, when we set out to create some sort of artwork that would capture Andrea's sex work experiences and combine her writing with my visuals, you know, we landed on a book first that was a collection of Andrea's stories paired with my photography. And our notion with that was that it was going to be Playboy if it were run by the bunnies, complete with a centerfold. So we did that first. And I think, you know, just from that start, we were always kind of playing with the notion of like what a book looks like. This was going to be an untraditional multimedia book experience. And so it felt like a natural progression to kind of also expand into film. And I am a film director. Andrea is not only a writer, she's also a performer. And so we always had these kind of cinematic dreams as we were thinking about the kind of things we would like to make. And so we started out in the short form, making a few short films together. And I would say we were always building to some sort of feature-length project that could tell Andrea's story in a more fulsome way, have more time to kind of show some of the funny experiences, some of the more challenging and darker experiences, and actually have time to get into the nuances of that. So yeah, we're really excited to have built towards this full-length feature film. I think Andrea's performance is like a tour de force in this. I'm so proud and excited for audiences to see it. And for me to craft the visuals and bring the book to life has been incredible. And I think we kind of try to have a unique aesthetic that speaks to the way that we want this story to be experienced.
Andrea, this film, this documentary, it features live action, it features animation. It's also very funny at times. There's a lot of nudity in it as well, but it's also, I think, educational, because at one point the documentary, this film, talks about, and something I've never heard of before, but sex reviews. Talk to me about sex reviews and what are they?
Wow, it's a whole world. So they're sort of formally known as escort review boards and escort review board culture, where the clientele of sex workers, not all of them, but a good chunk, hang out on these online platforms called escort review boards, and they review the sex workers that they've seen and that they've paid to have sex with. And you know, it's always a sort of like rite of passage for every sex worker to discover a review written about their sexual performance on one of these boards. It's deeply uncomfortable, often completely fabricated and untrue. However, you know, as the sex workers in the film talk about, sometimes these reviews can launch sex work careers, and sometimes they can be used as bait to coerce sex workers in the moment. And so it's quite the world, and something that we do in the book that we also do in the movie is, you know, we publish these reviews that were written about me, and then I get to respond to those reviews. And I get to write my review about that person in particular, because I remember these appointments. And so, yeah, we dramatize that in the film, and it's really funny. But it is kind of a disturbing underbelly that a lot of people don't know about.
Have they always been around, these review websites, essentially?
I mean, I guess probably for as long as the internet's been around, there's been men talking about women's bodies on the internet.
So, Nicole, the two of you are award-winning creatives in your own right. You won the Audience Award at both the Calgary Underground Film Festival and the Chicago Critics Film Festival in 2023 for the short film Thriving, Disassociated Reverie. Is that how is? Am I saying that? Is
yeah,
that the correct title?
Thriving, a Disassociated Reverie.
Yeah. So here's the question: getting those awards for the audience, coming from the audience, what does that mean to you, getting those awards from multiple film festivals from the audience?
I mean, it's absolutely incredible to have an award that comes from the audience. You know, it's I think, you know, so much of filmmaking is collaborative, and there's points in the process where you're working with other people and you're achieving the vision, but so much of it is kind of isolating, you know. You're making the work and you are trying to anticipate what you want an audience to feel from it and how it could resonate with them. But you're only ever anticipating that until your work actually gets out there into the world. And oftentimes you have to just ask yourself, does this resonate with me? Do I care about this? Does this excite me? And then hope that other people might feel the same way. So when your work actually finally makes its way to audiences and they actually embrace it and would give it such a legitimizing vote of approval that it actually is an audience award, it's incredible. I think it kind of shows that perhaps, you know, hopefully that I'm onto something as a filmmaker. It's very encouraging to have that kind of support as you continue in your career and make other projects and hope that other audiences will find them and also be excited. And I definitely feel that way about this one. I can't wait for this one to actually hit audiences at TIFF and beyond.
Andrea, how did the two of you originally meet? I guess back in 2011? How did the two of you meet?
Well, we met fortuitously on the set of a music video that Nicole was directing. I was recommended to play a go-go dancer on this music video. I'd heard a little bit about Nicole and I was really excited to meet her. And when I showed up, she was like, "Hi, I'm Nicole. I'm the director and I will also be playing the other go-go dancer," because she hasn't shown up. So the two of us got ready together, getting dolled up and talking and connecting. And we really hit it off. And from there, a beautiful, collaborative, creative friendship was born, where from the very beginning, we've been collaborating with each other in some capacity. And so, yeah, that's the story. That's our meet cute.
Okay. So in 2022, he contacts you after reading your memoir, Modern Horror. In 2023, you work as a consultant on his upcoming screenplay, and you teach his leading actress essentially how to tap into her, I would say, her modern whore, how to be a stripper. In 2024, this film makes its Canadian premiere at TIFF, and in 2025, this film wins the Oscar for Best Film of the Year. Andrea, talk to me about your involvement in Anora. How did this come about for you?
Yeah, it's a pretty wild story. And it starts with a DM on Instagram. Sean Baker slid into my DMs. There's no other way to say it. He like sent me a message. A week prior, I had watched The Florida Project for the first time. And I love that film. And I love the way that it handled a sex work component to the film. And so it was very surreal to get a message from the director so soon after watching his work and having admired his work for a long time, and also being highly aware of his reputation among sex workers as someone who inspired sex workers to tell their own stories on film. So he had reached out and said that he was working on yet another film that dealt with sex work, and he had read Modern Horror. He'd also listened to the audiobook. He loved it and was wondering if I did consultant work. And of course, I said yes. I was there's no possible world where I was going to say no to that opportunity. And so for many months, I worked with Sean and just going back and forth on the script from its early stages into its later, more refined stages, to just sort of check the representation of sex work in the writing to ensure that it felt as authentic as possible. And so I was only involved in that script stage. And then, of course, I did also get the opportunity to talk to Mikey Madison before they went to set to film Anora. About how she could tap into an inner archetype of, I don't want to say an inner archetype of whoredom, but essentially how she could tap into her own charisma and resilience and sense of humor in order to more authentically play a sex worker on screen. So that was a really like amazing conversation to have with her. And, you know, I didn't see the film until it premiered at TIFF last year, and I was blown away. And it was really exciting to see many of my recommendations on the screen. I was blown away by Mikey's performance. It's obviously an incredible film, and it's got all the accolades to show for it.
Were you surprised at the success of the film, especially when it comes to awards?
To be honest, not really. There's actually a really long history of sex worker films and women playing sex workers winning Oscars. So that actually doesn't surprise me that much. And it is an incredible film. And I could feel it, you know, as we were leading into TIFF last year, like there's serious momentum here because it had also won the Palme d'Or at Cannes only a few months prior. So it definitely felt like something big was going on. And I mean, it's a beautiful, incredible, fun, fast-paced, engaging, dynamic film. And so, yeah, I can't say I'm totally surprised by its, like, big award sweep.
Hmm. Here's my last question, and it's for the two of you. And Nicola, I'll start with yourself. But what do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen this very entertaining documentary, Modern Whore?
Yeah, I hope that, you know, it's going to depend on the audience member, but I hope that perhaps it resonates with them if they maybe have had sex work experience. And even if it doesn't resonate with them, you know, makes them feel like there's a shift hopefully happening where we can hear more stories and have, you know, yeah, all of the social and political change we want to see happen in terms of sex work. And, you know, and for those whom maybe this might be an introduction to the work, that they're going to come in with, you know, preconceived notions of what sex work is and who sex workers are, I'm hoping that they come out with feeling like they have so much to think about and consider, but their main takeaway would be these are human beings and we need them to be supported in our society. They need rights, you know, and I think that the personal is political in this instance, and having Andrea's story hopefully told well is, I think, a part of that.
And Andrea?
Yeah, I would echo everything Nicole said. That's definitely what I hope audiences get from the film as well. You know, I do think that art has the potential and the capacity to transform hearts and minds. And I think that that's something that needs to happen with how people perceive sex work and sex workers. I hope that audiences leave the theater feeling more understanding and more empathetic and more aware of the fact that these are human beings who have been the victim of prejudices for thousands of years. And we deserve human rights. We deserve equal protection under the law. We deserve to be treated with respect and dignity and love. And I hope most of all that sex workers feel represented and they feel seen. And I hope that they feel inspired to tell their own stories. I really, really do hope that if they don't feel represented on screen, they're at least inspired to tell their own stories, because there are so many stories that have never been told, and each and every single sex worker story is important.
Mm, well said, well said. Nicole Bazin, Andrea Warhan, thanks for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. This has been wonderful.
Yes, thank you, Mark.
My name is Andrea Warhan. I'm a writer and performer, and I'm also a sex worker.
In books, movies, and every syndicated crime drama imaginable, sex workers are typically portrayed as victims or villains. Shame and stigma can silence us. It's high time we told our own damn stories. Here's mine.
Modern Whore is currently screening at the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival. For more information, simply visit tiff.net.
Magnus Hirschfeld made the modern homosexual. He co-founded the world's first gay rights group, the Scientific Humanitarian Committee, in Berlin in 1897. But what is far more important is that he and his colleagues came up with an enormously influential concept of what same-sex desire was, what it meant, and how it fit into the wider world. If you think homosexuality is an inborn quality that cannot be changed and has a biological root, but is not an illness, and if you think gay people are a sexual minority who are born that way and who deserve legal protections just as racial minorities do, you owe those ideas to Hirschfeld and a handful of others. He was among the first to articulate that conceptual model of what it means to be gay in print in 1896.
We just heard professor, author, and historian of queer and trans politics, Lori Marhoefer, reading from Racism and the Making of Gay Rights, a sexologist, his student, and the Empire of Queer Love, their powerful new gay history book, about the man who made the modern homosexual, a German physician and sexologist who died at the age of 67 in 1935, Magnus Hirschfeld.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators' backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm Justin Ling, author of Missing from the Village. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country, a song that was part of the 1992 Oscar-winning film that won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. The artist, Boy George. The track is also the name of the movie, The Crying Game.
This is Michael Anthony Alago, music executive, photographer, author, and you are listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
This is hour two of Rainbow Country, where I feature music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. So if you stay with me, if you stick with me, I hope you think I'm bringing you music worth hearing. Starting us off, a classic disco set.
From here to eternity, that's where she takes me. From here.